Victoria gave them permission to land, and Johnny felt his way down through the rain clouds. His screens didn't clear up, but knowing the area, he could identify the scraps of image he sometimes glimpsed. It was useless to look through the screen. It looked like it had a fire hose being played on it. Johnny felt for the ground with his skids, more concerned about a bump affecting his passengers than about where he was. He did it very smoothly, and Pierre was again alarmed when Johnny turned off the motors. He thought they were still in the air. The rain was actually making it hard to talk in the cab of the plane. Johnny threw open the door, and there was Care standing there, water cascading off him in the plane lights. Even allowing for the deluge, Care was awfully glum-looking. He was usually very glad to see Johnny. The last time Johnny had been in Africa, he and Care had spent 3 nights working the Kariba rig. The planet Phobia had been very elusive. They had no coordinates for it beyond somewhere around the Cyclo Sun, and for a while it had seemed they would never discover it, and Care would eventually die from having no breathe gas. The planet was, however, located. It was doing a squashed ellipse. Phobia's perihelion, the point in its orbit where it was nearest its sun, was so much closer to its sun than its aphelion, the point in its orbit where it was furthest, and the distance to its sun from these two points was so vastly different, near and far, that anyone trying to live on Phobia would have perished, even a cyclo. Phobia went through 3 states. As it swung away from its sun, its atmosphere chilled and became liquid. As its distance increased, the liquid froze to solidity. As it again approached its sun, the sequence reversed and the atmosphere became gaseous again. But this long period of having a summer, and the Phobia year was about 83 of Earth's, permitted moss and other plants to grow, and these flourished for a time and then, as the atmosphere liquefied, remained in a state of suspended animation until summer came again. Although they had an awful time with camera triangulation to estimate its orbit, the end product had been beyond Care's wildest dreams. The planet was well into autumn, and it was no real trick to pump huge cable tanks full of liquid breathe gas. Not only that, but they had brought back about 50 tons of the material needed to make real goo food. Yes, Care had been acting like a cyclo gone to heaven, a most unlikely event, when Johnny and he had last met. And here he stood, glum in the rain.
"Hello, Johnny," he said woodenly.
"What's the matter with you?" said Johnny. "Lost your loaded dice?"
"Oh, it's not you, Johnny. I'm always glad to see you. It's that Maz. He was chief engineer here when the place was operating. One of the wounded ones. I got about 70 ex-prisoners from all over, and I'm trying to earn my pay by getting this tungsten mine going again."
He moved nearer, the rain cascading down his breathe gas mask, his tunic sodden with the hot rain that battered him.
"I'm no engineer," he suddenly wailed. "I was an operations officer. We ran out of ore body, and the next one is just beyond it someplace. That blank Maz and all those other blank cyclos just sit down there on their butts in gloom. Some blank fool showed them the pictures of cyclo blowing up, and they just won't do anything. I don't know any blank math, and I can't calculate the next ore deposits."
That's two of us, thought Johnny. He was glad the girls didn't speak cyclo. The ex-underworld midget could really swear, but he almost never did unless he was terribly upset. "That's why I'm here," he said.
"Really?"
Care brightened up like a mind charge had gone off in him. "Has McKendrick arrived?" said Johnny.
"Control got a drone report on a plane from Scotland. That McKendrick? He'd be about 3 hours behind you."
3 hours? Johnny had wanted to get to work right away. Well, there was something else he had to do first anyway. Get some cyclo corpses. "There's people in the back. Do me a favor and get them into the compound."
"Right,"
said Care, cheered up. He had a folded mine tarp on his arm he could use on the others as a rain shield. He sloshed toward the rear door, unfolding it. Pierre had been recovering. But now he was horrified to find that Johnny was rummaging around in a locker for high-altitude suits. Johnny threw one at him and began to pull on another one. Johnny heard the door slam in back and saw dim figures running toward the compound in the rain. He finished zipping up his suit and checked his fuel. Plenty. 20 seconds later, they were hurtling into the sky again. Pierre was still struggling into the unfamiliar high-altitude suit.
Mon Dieu! Life around Monsieur Tyler was hair-raising.
Johnny was unperturbed about it all. Up above the rain clouds, the screens were clean, and by seeing what stars were omitted, he could even eyeball the peaks. He left the plane lights on, heading for the glacial snows where they had left the cyclo corpses. He needed two, he thought. A workman and an executive. It did not help Pierre's frame of mind at all not to be told where they were going, nor why. Charging into the ink at such speeds appalled him. He did not even look at the view screens. His eyes were riveted through the now-streaked windscreen. Very shortly, Johnny was in the right location. He knew they had left a forklift up here. He would use that to guide in. He supposed that after all this time, the corpses would be pretty well covered with snow. But Pierre, not knowing what was being looked for or where or why, simply looked through the windscreen, his eyes dilated with something that was getting up close to terror. Suddenly, Pierre saw a whiteness. It had puffs blowing off it in the plane lights. With horror, he heard the engines wind down for a landing.
"Don't!" he screamed. "Don't! Don't! You're landing on a cloud!"
Johnny glanced up through the viewscreen. It did look like a cloud at that, seen from this angle. A high wind was blowing snow about. Ah, there was the forklift, up to its seat in snow and ice. The corpses would be lying, covered up, just beyond it. He had been flying by screens only. They were a long way from the nearest drop-off. He let the ship crunch down into the snow and shut off the motors. The wind was screaming up here, enough to make the plane tremble. Johnny settled his air mask on tighter. "Get out and give me a hand." Pierre was in total confusion. He had clearly seen them land on a cloud, and he could not understand what was holding the ship up. He knew, from their earlier course, that they must be close to, if not on, the Earth's equator, and recent studies had told him that the equator was very hot. So snow was the furthest thing from his imagination. His small tribe had been under the domination of Jesuit priests, and they had controlled by instilling a heavy fear of heaven and hell, mostly the latter. The reputation of Monsieur Tyler was itself a matter of growing superstition and awe. It surprised him less that they had landed on a cloud than it did to be told to get out. Pierre looked at the puffs of white in the ship's light. Yes, a cloud. He fingered the image of a crucified Christ that hung about his neck. He felt he was too young to be a martyr. But there was a solution. He snatched the jet backpack from the compartment behind the seat and hastily shrugged into it. Monsieur Tyler quite probably was able to walk on clouds, but that didn't include Madame Solon's son, Pierre. It took a lot of courage to open the door, but he did so. He closed his eyes tightly and sprang out, hand on the backpack firing trigger. It was about 8 feet down from a seat of such a plane to the ground, but Pierre had been nerved up to fall 12,000. When he hit the ground, despite snow, he almost broke his legs. Pierre fell backward in total confusion and lay propped on his elbows in the snow. He could not understand why he had not fallen through the cloud. Johnny, intent on his project, was oblivious of all this confusion. He had taken a mine crowbar from the plane's toolkit and was prospecting through the snow for the corpses. They certainly were covered up. The tip of the iron bar found one. He knelt and brushed away some snow, the particles flying away in the wind. He uncovered the tip of a breathe gas mask and then the ornament of a cap. Yep, an executive. He felt around under the monstrous shoulders to see where he had to insert the flat end of the crowbar to pry the monster loose from the adhesions of ice. One of these cyclos weighed about 1,000 pounds, more in all this snow and ice. Johnny inserted the crowbar deeper and heaved down on it. The monster was so stuck that the top end of the bar slipped and tore open his high-altitude jacket fastenings. He tried again, this time giving it all the strength he had. With a creaking, low-pitched sound, the monster moved upward. But the sound must have been close to that of clearing one's throat. The bank's singing button in his pocket gave out a ballad line with a baritone voice.
Ghost riders in the sky.
Pierre, already badly shaken, beheld a demon rising from out of the cloud. And not only that, it was singing in a sepulchral voice. It was a lot too much. With a low moan, he fainted dead away. 5. Johnny loosened the workman's corpse with the bar and then went to the forklift and knocked ice out of its cogs and ratchets. He was about to start it up when he noticed the absence of Pierre. He had expected him to open the loading doors of the plane, at least. He spotted the man lying in a shadow made by a balance motor. The snow was already blowing over him. A bit anxiously, he checked to see if he was injured, puzzled by the presence of the jet backpack, wondering why he was lying there unconscious. Well, this was no place for even first aid. Johnny got the forklift moving and scooped up Pierre. He ran the machine down the length of the ship to the doors and, standing on the seat, got them open. But the wind, coming from the tail of the plane, was trying to bang the door closed. Johnny jumped up to the fuselage flooring in hopes of finding something to block the door and stopped in his tracks. Patty. She was still in the plane. They must have overlooked her in their scramble to get through the rain. She made so little sound and motion these days, she easily went unnoticed. She must be freezing. Johnny opened an equipment locker and dragged out a blanket and threw it around her. She hardly even looked up. All he could find to block the door open was the stick from a map roller, and he tried to make it do by butting it against a floor equipment ring and pushing it against a hinge. He got down and operated the forklift to boost the inert body of Pierre into the plane. He had almost made it when a powerful gust of wind banged the door shut. Once more he climbed into the plane to try to make the stick prop the door, but this time the frail wood splintered. A soft voice sounded behind him.
"I will hold it open for you."
Patty, gripping the blanket to her with one hand, put the other on the door and braced it open. This was the first time he had seen her volunteer anything for months. Johnny jumped down onto the forklift and raised Pierre up and dumped him on the floor plates. He got into the plane once more and began tugging the man over to the side out of the way, and was a bit amazed to see Patty pulling on the body to help. So, with Patty to hold the door open, Johnny was able to fork the two monstrous bodies out of the snow and dump them into the plane. Patty was watching him, and what he was doing, intently. Shortly, he parked the forklift, closed up the plane, and got into the cab out of the cutting wind. He phoned the compound to have a flatbed and forklift waiting, and then, checking to see if Patty was strapped in, shot the plane up into the sky. He had been prepared to feel his way down through the overcast with half-blind screens, and was very happy to see that the worst of the storm and all of its electrical interference had passed by. It was no longer raining at the compound, and they had every pole spotlight on. Quite a crowd had gathered around the waiting vehicles to see the plane come in. The last time Johnny had seen some of these ex-Marines and ex-spacemen had been through gun sights, and it was a trifle strange beholding Jambit Chows and Hawbins and such standing around, but they seemed inoffensive enough. Three Chatavarian engineers in bright orange work suits that had Desperation Defense written on their chests were in the crowd, probably there doing preparatory surveys to convert this mine site protection over to the new system. A new plane was there with nobody around it, and Johnny realized that McKendrick must have arrived. He called Patty forward, and with her under one arm, jumped down from the plane. Care was sitting on a forklift. "The co-pilot is in there. He's breathing, but he must be injured or something," said Johnny. "Get him and the two cyclos down to the hospital." Johnny, still carrying Patty, rushed into the compound to find McKendrick. Care promptly got busy with the forklift and, with an expertise only care could achieve with a machine, scooped all three bodies off the floor of the Marine attack plane and swooshed them over to the flatbed. The driver, a newly trained Jambit Chow, looked on in wide-eyed shock as he saw two huge cyclo bodies plump down on the truck with a small human body dropping on top of them. The first impulse of the crowd seeing cyclos was to retreat, and fast. All the snow and ice had melted off them, and to all appearances they might be alive. The driver was about to get off the truck and put distance between himself and anything that had to do with cyclos that might suddenly come to life. Care withdrew the forks and realized he was in the middle of a commotion and was about to have no driver.
"No, no," he shouted. "They're dead."
Timidly, the Jambit Chow got back on the flatbed seat. Cautiously, the crowd crept forward to get a closer look. Eyes went questioningly to Care.
"Didn't you hear what Johnny told me?"
said Care. No, they hadn't. Too far away.
"Those cyclos," said Care, "have been hiding out in the jungle. They rushed out of cover and started to claw the co-pilot to bits. And it made Johnny so mad he charged them. He grabbed the throats of both of them at the same time and just plain strangled them to death."
Mouths were open and eyes were popped. The evidence was right there before them. After a moment, a Hauven ex-officer said,
"No wonder we lost this war."
"Yes," said Care. "When you get to know Johnny better, you'll realize that when he gets mad, he gets mad."
He signaled the flatbed to follow and drove off in the forklift. He just couldn't resist doing what he'd done. But the hardest part was to keep from guffawing in their faces.